Like kids, data is a labor of love. And on today's episode, I am joined by the brilliant and open and sharing and kind Tasha Van Vlack, who chats with me about the lessons we have both learned from being parents, me of two kids, she of three, and how those lessons we've learned from being parents helps us in supporting nonprofits and everything from marketing, donations, data, and everything in between. We explore what the sleepless nights and battles over wearing underwear have taught us about how we can lean into research to help us be better at what we do, how we can balance the need to personalize while learning from the commonalities and lessons of others, and so many more things. Whether you are a parent or not, there is so much to learn about how we can be more effective in accomplishing the great things we are up to in our nonprofits. Hello, and welcome to Heart, Soul, and Data, where we explore the human side of analytics to help amplify the impacts of those out to change the world. With me, Alexandra Mannerings.
I'm so excited to be joined today by a fellow mom and brilliant business person and champion of the nonprofit space. So Tasha, go ahead and introduce yourself.
Sure. Thanks so much for having me. This is really fun. And I've loved our conversations over the past, couple months since we met. So I'm Tasha Van Vlack. I currently am a relationship growth specialist, which my lovely boss basically gave me a title that covers that. I do everything from sales to marketing to customer success, client growth. And I kind of came to the nonprofit world via a very hilarious path in that I have a biology degree. I've taught English as a second language. I've been in sales for a very long time and then was introduced 5 years ago to the nonprofit space in like a client management capacity, then worked in a Salesforce space for a while. And so it's just been very slow meandering way to what I think is what I do really well, which is managing people's growth and managing what they'd like to accomplish and just being a champion and cheerleader. So that's kind of my new role that I love the most for sure.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to chat today. And I am thrilled for what we get to talk about today, because we've connected over so many things, whether the biology background, you're teaching me to be more vulnerable in a more public way to really connect to people, which I love that challenge. And one of the things I know that we both share a lot about is our families. And we've had some fun conversations about what lessons have we learned from being moms and parents and family managers, but also women with careers. And so how can we take the lessons that we learned from our families and apply them to data and the nonprofit world? So that's where we're going to have a conversation today about, and I am thrilled about it.
It's really fun. It's kind of, I don't think it's expected. I even love the phrase you just used, which is family manager, because I think I should have that on my LinkedIn profile, family manager for the past 11 years. And it's absolutely the hardest role I have. But I talk about it a little bit, like we connected over LinkedIn with the parenting piece at the beginning, right? So yeah, I'm really excited to talk about this too, because it definitely influences all areas of my life.
I've seen a really, probably several times, conversations on LinkedIn of women talking about this idea of, can we list it on our resume? Can we list like managing our family? And resoundingly, the answer is yes, we should be able to because of the skills that you do learn, which we'll talk about today. So what one would you like to start with? What's our first lesson that we've learned from being parents?
Oh, man. Lots. Like, there's less so much. I don't even know where to exactly start.
Where to start.
But I do think, at least for me personally, giving a slight bit of background as a mom, and maybe you could do the same, maybe is a good place to start, because I think everyone's a little bit different in their parenting journey. So for myself, I have three little ones. They are not so little anymore. They're 11, 10, and 6. And our first two were 14 months apart. So unplanned, but very much wanted, and was a very exciting time, but also overwhelming because it felt like I went from nothing to everything very quickly. And our second oldest was initially, everyone was like, oh, colicky baby. And then it became maybe it's something else. Maybe it's a food allergy. Maybe it's reflux. Maybe it's a sensory disorder. And it's just never quite gotten easy, I guess. You know, I've got his sister was like this beautiful cherub baby that was so easy and would go to anybody. And then he's been my, I've learned so much from being his parent, even though it's been hard won every step of the way. So I think having that background is going to influence a lot of what I talk about, because he, I'm sure I will write someday a book about what it's been like being his mother, but I have a feeling it'll be one of the things I'm the most proud of as well. If I get there successfully to the end of this. What about yourself with parenting?
Yeah, no, I love this. So I have two kiddos. They've just turned 6 and 4. So my son is 6 and my daughter is 4. And my husband is British. So I joke that we have a mixed family, though from the outside, it doesn't always look that way, because we do come from very different parenting cultures, very different communication styles. And that's been really interesting as well in looking at how we parent and how we talk about parenting and how our kids are learning, you know, to respond to different parenting styles. And I mean, they have hilarious mixed British American accents.
Oh my goodness, that's so cute. Is it kind of like Emily Blunt and John Krasinski when they talk about their kids being able to like switch back and forth and say water differently and all of those cute things?
So my kids have not figured out how to switch yet. They're not quite aware yet of the way that they sound, but what they have is British pronunciation of words with American intonation and cadence.
That's amazing.
The way they string sentences together and the way they like enunciate those sentences is very American. But the words they say, they drop all the R's off their ends of their words and everything.
Which, I love that. Yeah.
But I sort of similar to you, my son was a terrible sleeper, like a terrible sleeper. And we'll talk a little bit about this with sleep training. But
yes,
it was hard to feel like even at the very beginning, the most basic thing you're supposed to teach your kid, that I was failing at it. And then you're just exhausted.
And it's one of those items that for whatever reason, the older generation, like my parents, my husband's parents, are like, this is somehow a you problem, because we didn't have bad sleepers. Like our kids slept. My mom keeps telling the story of, you know, well, I think your sister was about 6 weeks and you were harder. You were 12. And I'm going, 12 weeks without sleep sounds dreamy, because, you know, I think I was a solid 18 months with like no more than 2 to 3 hours. And, you know, you try to describe to somebody else what it's like to not remember driving places. I actually stopped driving on a highway at all because I was terrified I was going to kill us all, because I would have these zone out moments where I would get somewhere. And so I was only going a couple blocks, you know, when I was driving just within town, because I felt safe there and felt like I knew it. And I'd get to playgroup and be like, how did I get? I don't remember the drive, right? And you're going, this is bad news, right? Like, I am super worried about, you know, how I'm feeling. And I don't know whether it's something newer because of parenting styles changing, but I feel like sleep is something that is much more discussed, and all of us agonize over what we're doing wrong and why is it so hard. And yeah, sleep is like a differentiator in the parenting journey for sure.
And I think it encapsulates something that's a broader lesson of how much are we allowed to acknowledge personal struggles we're having in terms of their impact of how we're existing in the wider world. Right? Whether
Absolutely.
That's in our business or in our job, if we're running a business or working for someone else, or whether that's in like our public relationships, our public presence, our public persona, and to say how much is it, and I'm going to put air quotes around this, okay, to acknowledge and admit or even just share, hey, here's what's happening in my personal life and why it might actually be impacting what I'm capable of doing in other areas of my life.
Yeah. Well, and I think there's even, you can see some of the shift. And LinkedIn is such an interesting space exactly for this reason. I think it's just, you can see a bit of the shift of there are some people talking about their struggles and others are not. And it is creating kind of two different camps of what we've all thought of as professionalism and the separation of work and home. But the reality is we've all been kidding ourselves if we don't think, in the same way that I struggle sometimes with remote work and not working at 8 p.m. at night, how can we not think that our home life and the fact that I'm trying to organize a birthday party for a 6-year-old and get on the phone with the birthday party place is not influencing my work day? It's impossible. I don't know. I don't even try to get to separate the two out anymore, because with remote work especially, it's so intertwined. And I am happy that at least there's some recognition of that now.
I agree. And that's been a fun journey for me to acknowledge how being a parent as part of my identity influences who I am professionally. And whether for better or worse, depending on the day.
Yeah. Oh, for depending on the day is totally true, right? You have a great morning and everyone heads off to school and there's no meltdowns and you feel like you can take over the world. Or sometimes I sit at my desk at 8:30 and I feel like I've had a whole day that happened before I sat down at 8:30. And so, yeah, you can come into a day pretty tired already.
Right. After you spent 17 minutes trying to convince your son to put his socks on.
I know. Why don't they like socks? Right. Like, I don't know. I live in Canada. Like, you need socks in the winter. It's a non-negotiable item. It just shouldn't be a comment, but it is.
Agreed. Well, I feel like we've already gotten into lesson number one about
yes,
sharing our private personas publicly or our private challenges publicly. So yes, which one do we want to do next?
Okay. So I was trying to think through some of the pieces of what I took away from sleepless night struggles in particular, and that piece of parenting where you go in without a book on the child that you have, right? So I felt like parenting has really influenced my ability to, I don't know, critically look at kind of A/B testing, right? And research even. I was already, you know, I have a biology degree. I had to put together a thesis. I had to do all of those pieces. But I had no idea what research was like until I became a parent. I have 15 books on sleep on a shelf downstairs, and I'm pretty sure we got rid of the ones that we thought were not useful. And the other ones are still there because I'm going, well, he's 10, but who knows? Like, we may still need this someday. I'm terrified to give them away. And so I guess that A/B testing, that ability to go, well, let's try this for 2 weeks. Let's research this, has never been stronger than being a parent and having to kind of really learn something to that depth again.
I think with nonprofits, because we are trying to tackle those big, hairy problems that don't, just like our kids, didn't come with a playbook of here's how to solve them.
Oh, man. So true.
Right? Yes. Right? Like, okay. But in the same way, there are sometimes pockets of examples where progress has been made or solved in a slightly, like a different situation has been solved, right? We could look at different cities that tried something that our city's trying to do, just the same way that you read books on sleep and said, oh, hang on, I have a very, very, very big problem here if my kid not sleeping. How do I solve this? And you turned to experts who had a lot of experience in that space to say, here's generally things that we've seen work. We've collected research on it to show impacts of different methods. And like, we can do that too when we're trying to solve hunger or homelessness or any of the things that we're trying to deal with. And there's not just like a manual where as long as you follow the 12 steps, it's going to work. And so that's where the testing comes in. And that idea of A/B testing, meaning I'll try approach A, I'll try approach B, and we'll compare the results and we'll see which one gives us something better. And then we can try to do more of the one that seemed to work and continue to iterate off of the one where we see progress happening.
Absolutely.
And I think that's such an important lesson in everything that we do, because so many things of what we do, it's not clear how we're going to be able to be successful.
And I think there's so much too with both nonprofits and parents and sleep is that you're bogged down in the weeds sometimes. You're unable to get a clear view of what is happening, how to sometimes even test it and then gather the data and then analyze it. When you're desperate for sleep or you're desperate for funds or desperate for donations, you're not always able to analyze and then make informed decisions in the way that we would like to, at our best selves, be able to look at that information too. I mean, I've had Tim Locke on LinkedIn always puts out such great posts surrounding nonprofits and some of the struggles of data collection. And, 40% of nonprofits are using their data in some sort of informed way, right? To actually make decisions, but almost all of them are collecting data. So what are we doing with that data? Like, where does it go? Were we just collecting it just because, and that's a real problem that I have seen frequently out there, is that there's a decision to collect and then, but is it informing you to go, this was a better path than this path? Or when we're in desperation mode, do we make great decisions or do we just scramble sometimes to do something, right? To say that we're actually accomplishing something versus nothing.
There was a debate in the hospital patient safety space for a while, about 5 years ago, where the discussion of how do we improve patient safety was being debated of,
do we take the time to conduct these either controlled experiments or, you know, a randomized controlled trial is the best way of doing it, where you actually assign different patients to receive different treatments and see what comes out of that. Or at least doing more in-depth studies of saying what happens when we sort of see more natural experiments of patients choosing different approaches to solving a problem or hospitals choosing different ways to try to tackle one of these patient safety problems. And there was this big letter written by someone who basically was trying to make the claim, we don't have time to experiment, right? Like, people's lives are at risk. We can't waste time trying things. And I remember just sitting there going, well, hang on. What are you going to do then when you have to rush to make this decision? And we have to just decide how we're going to reduce readmissions or reduce falls or reduce infections. How are you picking how you're going to do that if we, quote unquote, don't have time to experiment? And it was, as you were saying, when you're so buried in it, you know, here are experts in this field, this is what they do. But they were so deep into the overwhelming challenge and pressure of saving lives that they didn't feel like they could take that step back and do what really would have saved more lives and do that research.
Yeah. And I mean, not all nonprofits are in a space, obviously, where life and death decisions are getting made, because that's huge. And if anything, there should be more care and attention and obviously budget put towards those kinds of decisions. But I do think for so many nonprofits, the discussions of overhead mean that data collection, data analysis, experimentation is not even a possibility, in the same way that in the educational space, there's just a little bit more funds kind of that's part of the process. That experimentation piece is a natural part of a biology degree. That's just what you do. That's part of what it is. And maybe from a marketing background, from what I do for work, when you don't give time to experiment, to optimize, you get a lens view that is very just myopic, because you haven't had a chance to kind of look from all angles. And that does take time. But just like with my kid in sleep, I wanted him to sleep tomorrow, not months later, right? And I couldn't imagine not sleeping tomorrow. And so it does become something that I think nonprofits have to start considering for sure as being worth an investment, and parents.
That we have to be willing to try things and give it enough time, but also make sure that we're measuring the outcome that we're hoping for to see if we're getting it.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. So I was trying to think what else in the same vein. I was trying to think what we talked about a little bit in the past, but I think it all ties together in that this taught me that flexibility is key.
Yes.
Yeah. That really flexibility as a, you know, to look at the data as it's incoming, but also as a marketer, I'm constantly going, okay, is this kind of leading me to believe after a 2-week sprint that I'm on the right path, or do I need to reevaluate all of this?
One of the things I've had to learn to be really flexible about as well is the whole like minimum viable product thing. So like with my kids, I love to cook and I love to bake. And they both expressed interest in joining me in those endeavors. And especially with baking, right? Measuring is important. There's a big difference between 1 teaspoon of baking powder and a tablespoon of baking powder, or 3.5 flung-in teaspoons of baking powder. And
absolutely.
I've had to really work on just saying, you know what? However this cake turned out will be okay. Like, I'm going to be flexible enough that it's just a cake. If I end up having to make it again, it's okay. Like,
yes.
Even if it's not perfectly round, or like there's too much baking powder in it, or whatever it is, like, it'll be okay. Because what's more important here is the process of helping my kids learn how to cook and be engaged with me and to build that. Like, really, what's my goal? Is a perfect cake, or is it having this strong relationship with my kids and teaching them a really important life skill? And I feel like that's the same with data, of like, I do the same thing where I want perfect data. Right? I want to collect perfect data. And I have to just like have that flexibility of like, you know what? Maybe we'll collect it this way. Maybe we won't. We'll be okay. We'll do the best we can. And if it's not perfect, we're going to move forward and we'll figure out how to make it work.
Absolutely. And so just out of curiosity, but like, what's your thoughts on how much data to collect? Because I think that's even a real challenge for nonprofits, where like squirrels with nuts. So we're going to collect it all.
Right.
There's never a plan to use it all, but we're going to collect it all. I don't know, what's your thoughts on that, on prioritizing data?
Funny thing is, that ties to the second lesson I've had to learn with my kids about picking your battles, like which hills are you going to die on versus what are you going to let go? And it's the same conversation with how much data do you collect? And I prioritize them the same way, which is how much benefit is this piece of data going to give? How critical is it to the things that I need to do? And so like making my son wear underwear to school because we really can't have butts showing, right? Like that is an important thing. And same as like knowing the amounts that your donors are giving you, that's like a non-negotiable. You need to know that because it's the fun, like the foundation of everything that you're going to do and understanding how your donors are interacting with you. Now, things like your donor's birthday, might be nice that you want to send them a birthday greeting and like make that extra connection, but it's not essential for you understanding how they interact with you. And yes. So I think being really clear, how are we going to use this piece of data, right? Or how am I going to make sure that my son is properly clothed to school? Like these things that are just required in order to actually do the things you're trying to accomplish, those are the ones that you focus on. If you look at a piece of data and you can't make an argument about why what it's used for is going to be essential to achieving your mission, then it might be okay to let it go. Or at least say, I'm not going to collect it now. Not yet. Maybe someday my daughter won't wear all dresses and tights all the time. But like, I don't have to have that battle right now because she is clothed. And that's the most important part.
Yeah, absolutely. And like our team does a lot of donation form optimization work that, you know, looking into email cadence, how many emails is the best number of emails? And, you know, is there a call to action in all emails or are some of them just very thank you based and more informative about what's going on? But I do think even in that space, you'll get some clients who want to have a donation form that's this long with all these questions. Obviously, it'd be great to know how they heard about you, but is that critical? Is that a critical piece of information? Is that going to, you know, with somebody on a mobile phone, make them go, crap, there's all these extra questions. All I wanted to do was give a donation. Those are real considerations.
You bring up a great point that there is a cost to collecting data. There's a cost to whoever's inputting the data. There could be a cost actually where you turn a donor away in the name of trying to collect too much data. And again, the same way that there is a cost for every time I have a fight with my kids over doing something, right? There's an emotional cost. There's a relationship strain in terms of on both me. I don't like having to have, you know, be the evil Grinch in the morning, insisting on getting up on time.
Yes.
But, so choosing where am I going to spend that emotional energy or with data, like what am I going to spend my time, my technical resources and the risk of potentially like upstream issues of whoever's inputting it. Or the challenges of actually collecting that data. Am I going to offend somebody for asking a certain question? There's a lot of things that we have to remember that collecting data is not a neutral activity.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, I'm trying to remember, Ainsley Fender, and she's kind of in the grant management space, has some really great conversations frequently around the idea of, is a grant worth it? Like even once you apply, which is its own huge cost, if you've got a local $5,000 city related grant for your nonprofit, but the maintenance work means that like you should be thinking of the cost of the maintenance work of that grant all the time, because if you have to be able to put reports together on constituents that are served and the number of hours that you put into individual people, and do you have the systems to even manage that, or are you going to be putting it into an Excel doc and trying to then amalgamate a report later? I've talked to her quite a few times. She's brilliant. And she just totally gets the space and has been the grant manager for other nonprofits, small nonprofits, which is how she kind of got started. And she's just not wrong. She's like, you know, like, yes, we'd all love to measure impact and everything. And that's really important. And that's what donors want to see is impact. But what some grants are asking for, you should always have a critical eye before you even apply. It's going to take X amount of time. But what could you do with those man hours if you weren't managing a grant, right?
100%. And it's hard sometimes to think about giving up those resources coming in.
Yes.
The same way as it's hard to be like, but I want my child to be like perfectly presented to the world and immaculately combed hair and everything. But you're like, well, but what's the cost of achieving that? And is the cost of achieving that worth what I'm going to get? Is the cost of administering that grant and accomplishing everything we're required to do worth the resources that'll come in? And it's a real question to ask.
It is, absolutely. And just even like, I mean, the training capacity too, right? Because now I'm at the point where I would say my training capacity as a parent, you know, although I kind of laugh because now I am great with like 16-month-old babies. Like I can entertain those that like I've done that 3 times. I'm pretty good at that age group, right? Now it's like a bunch of 11-year-old girls. Turns out I'm not as cool as I was when I was, actually not a cool 11-year-old at all, but I don't know what they're all up to. And they're kind of more challenging to sometimes manage. Whereas going and hanging out with my friends, 16-month-old, she thought I was just the bee's knees. And all I was doing was willingly flipping through a book, right? The pockets open. And I was going, this is awesome. I could do this, right? So there is also that expertise cost. Do you have someone on your team who knows how to collect data?
Yes.
The way you need to? Can they do it? Can they set these systems up for you in a third of the time as some brand new person that's going to have to start from scratch figuring out how to gather that information?
As my son has gotten older, exactly to that point, like realizing there are limits to my expertise on things that may actually benefit him. And so like I signed him up for chess club at school because he was super interested in learning how to do chess. And I was like, that is not something that I am going to be able to teach you at all. And so if we feel that this is a good thing for you to experience and you've decided this is something you want to do, we're bringing in someone else to help us with that. Like off you go to chess club because I'm going to outsource that need. It is not something that is worth the time for me to try to figure out how to do. And I'm not going to do it well because not only do I not know chess, I have no concept of how you would translate the lessons of chess to a six-year-old. And yet he loves his chess coach. He thinks it's the coolest thing. He has so much fun in it. And I was thinking about that, like whether it's data reporting or donor management, whatever it is, marketing, your storytelling, like if it's something you decide is necessary for your organization and you can't do it, figuring out how you can get someone who is good at it to do it for you is where to go.
Absolutely. I mean, I very much have sunk time and energy into things afterwards where I'm going, I'm only ever going to be just like middle of the road at this. This is clear. I am never going to be. That is something that I think with age, as well as limited time as a parent, you know, 25-year-old me was more than happy to keep on plugging away, figuring out how to do it. But, you know, almost 40-year-old me is going, this is never going to be me, even just in my work as with marketing. I am not willing to dip my toes into TikTok right now because I'm like, the amount of things I need to learn to use TikTok, I don't have time for this, right? And so I'll continue to troll around on Instagram and because I know how to do that. And I know that they're not even that different, but, you know, and meanwhile, my 11-year-old showed me how to use what she's making trailers on like Apple products and stuff like that. I'm going, how did you do that? But, you know, she has all the time. She's just like, I got time to, so she showed me how to do it. So, you know, you can pick it up if time is unlimited and it turns out you're great at it. There's also, if you had all the time in the world, you may still only be kind of just okay at it, right? So same thing, like you said, for chess, do you have time or do you think you're going to be that person? If not, find the expert, let them handle it, right?
Yep, absolutely. I know one of the other things like that both with parenting and with nonprofits and data is the same question of, well, my child's unique. No other child's like mine. So like what else, who could possibly have anything to teach me about my kid or how could research ever help me because this child's never existed before. We've talked about how there's no manuals before. So I wondered if you wanted to talk a little bit about where we can bring the power of research and data, even when we're dealing with real human beings that are unique and different.
Yeah. So I think that harkens back to everyone's a special snowflake. No one's a special snowflake. But, you know, we kind of go back and forth in our comfort level with personalization. And I think there's a lot to be said for in parenting. Ultimately, you have each child that you very much realize. I think for a while there, I had a daughter and then a son. And then I had another son. Guess what? Nothing is applicable between the two boys and nothing is applicable between siblings almost, right? We all like Marvel. That's about it. Everything else is kind of, you know, across the board. So that was a really good lesson in thinking that I had some, even, you know, you kind of try to group like and go, well, they're two boys. Well, that really doesn't matter that much. So with parenting, when I get together and talk with other parents, we're looking for commonalities between our parenting experience to take one experience and apply it across the board to many. And sometimes that works really well. The book, What to Expect When You're Expecting, useless to me. Nothing went like I expected in childbirth, baby years, sleeping, anything. I stopped even looking at the book after our second because I was going, I can't use this, right? It was too generalized, just extreme generalization. So I think there is that sweet spot to go, there are commonalities, but overreaching generalization isn't going to work. With nonprofits, I do think there's a space to gather your data on all of your constituents. But as you start to gather that data, segmentation, particularly in email lists, donor stewardship, can be very, very valuable because it at least gives you a smaller subset. When I was working within Salesforce, there's a couple reports where it's like Libunt. So last year, but unfortunately not this year, is a report that you can generate on donors. And so those who had not donated yet, you'd have this structured list, then you could filter it based on donation size that they did last year. So you could kind of decide by time how you wanted to dig in. But at the end of the day, I would still be going and looking into one-on-one correspondence with that person before I reached out every single time. Because if that person gave a $500 donation and there was a lot of stewardship involved and the staff member that reached out to them last year is no longer here, they're going to probably need a very different interaction than the donor who's given every year. But for some reason, it hasn't happened quite this year yet. But you know, we're pretty consistent. We've got a great relationship. That's really going to change. But that information is always that kind of information for fundraising is, I can't see how it's not going to be used. That, like, you know, so I think it's almost like prioritizing some of your practices to go, we always use fundraising data. Maybe over time you bring in marketing data. Maybe you actually have to go, we're going to start up here and then we're slowly going to bring in information below. Or like when you were talking about the hospital example, you know, maybe a hospital foundation or a greater hospital, more social services. The priority on data is going to be on client services first and foremost, not fundraising, because for them, it's government-based money. Fundraising is not a big deal. So yes, nonprofits are going to be unique in what they prioritize, but I think there must be some data you're always going to need to make informed decisions of how you grow or how you service your community.
I was thinking about the difference in when you use data for donation outreach, similar to thinking about my son in kindergarten, because this is his first year in public schools. He's been in kindergarten. He's one of 24 in his class with a single teacher. Yeah. And this woman is an angel. I don't know how she manages this class. But it is interesting because when I think about managing my son, I'm making choices about him.
Yeah.
Right? Based on what I know about him and an action that I'm going to take that is just going to impact him and me. But his teacher, his kindergarten teacher, has to make a single action to manage the 24 kids together. And I think that where data, right, it's insane.
It's crazy.
And I think that with data, it also, versus personalization, it comes down to what level are you taking action on?
Yeah.
Right? If you're going to send an email, like a form email,
yeah,
using data to help drive that email, inform that email, pick the segment that email goes to, or maybe some customizations, like automatic customizations within that email, data is essential for that and would
Absolutely.
Be the right thing to use because you're not picking up the phone and calling one person. When you pick up that phone to call them, you can use data to prep and understand likelihood of reaction, right? Somebody who's donated yeah. for 10 years, which you can see from the data, is going to react to your call likely, you know, in a different way than somebody who hasn't donated for 5 years. But at the yeah. end of the day, your one-on-one phone call with that donor is going to be a human custom relationship and interaction that's not necessarily completely driven by data. It's going to be driven by that one-on-one personalization. Whereas, again, like your interactions when you're putting your web form up, right? You can't yeah. have a one-on-one reaction with a web form. So you're going to use data and A/B testing to try to optimize that form, understanding that it's the single action going out to lots of different people at the same time.
Well, and something that can be really challenging when we're talking about data, and I think it's even part of the nonprofit discomfort with data in general, because a lot of nonprofit individuals, very passionate, very driven. There's a lot of feelings involved. Like, you know, as a marketer, you know, marketing to nonprofits, feeling can win out. We talk about vibe checks. You've never had like the conversations between sales of B2B sales to organizations that are not nonprofits. It's very data-driven conversations. It's very, what am I going to get out of this? How is this going to move my business forward? And they could hate your guts and they're still going to choose you because you said you were going to do this. And there, it may not feel great in terms of personal to person, but the data says this is a good mm-hmm. choice. Instead, there's a lot of nonprofit interactions or interactions as a consultant with nonprofits that your vibe check, you could lose out. You could put the best proposal together, but there's, if they don't have that feeling that this is a good match, you're never going to get anywhere. And I think you see that too in the donor stewardship journey, where there are some small nonprofits that are killing donor stewardship. And there's a lot to be learned for grassroots, personalized, relational interactions that a smaller nonprofit can manage that larger nonprofits start to lose out on when they bring in a lot of data. Because instead, the data is making decisions versus the human element still making decisions, right? The data can inform it. I think that's very important. And so there's probably some middle ground, right? But mid-sized nonprofits are probably doing this best. But, you know, we can't also let the data be making the decisions. I think humans still need to make the decision. And data, like this data, is still humans at the end of the day. There's humans behind that fall at the hospital. And there's humans behind your donation. And keeping that lens and that reminder, Mina Das on, again, I'm dropping all of my favorite people to like listen to on LinkedIn, but she, you know, she talks about human-centric focus on data and how to, you know, run surveys with the humans at the back of it, right? Like, how is this survey going to look to somebody that's the other person on this? Yes, you want this information, but there's a way to present the information that makes people feel more comfortable engaging. And yeah, so I guess there is some sort of middle ground. And I think data is critical, but I think sometimes our perception of data is injuring our ability to use it well.
Agreed. This is one of the things that I spend as much time as I can in any education opportunity I get in conversations with nonprofits, of saying, where is data appropriate?
Yeah.
Where do we use data most effectively? And where does it not belong at all?
Absolutely.
In conversations, the analogy of the car, right? That we talk about dashboards for data, yep, and dashboards on cars, right? The dashboard doesn't steer the car.
Yes.
But I sure want to know how fast I'm going and how much fuel
absolutely
I have left in order to make decisions about what I'm doing with that steering wheel and the gas pedal and the brake. And so while I'm making the decisions, and I'm making those decisions based on the things that matter to me, right? Am I running late? Am I running low on fuel? All those different things. Is it snowing outside? Like, I'm making those decisions, but it's really hard, yeah, to drive effectively if you have no data available to yourself, to the, you in making those decisions. And trying to help nonprofits understand that the data is not there to tell you what to do. The data is there to give you some key information that probably won't even be everything you need to know. Still need to know how to drive. I need to know which pedal's gas and which pedal's brake. Like, I asked my son once, I was really tired, and I was like, can you drive me home? And he looks at me and he goes, Mom, that would be a terrible idea.
Terrible idea. Terrible idea.
Like, totally without missing a beat. That would be a terrible idea, Mom. You know I would just crash the car. He goes, in fact, I can't even reach the pedals and I don't know which way the steering wheel goes.
There's such a honesty with children sometimes, right? Like, I'm always blown away sometimes. It was like, I remember watching kids say the darndest things when I was like a teenager and being like, I never said anything that's foolish. And then you're a parent and you're going, this could be a reality TV show at my house every day with the crazy stuff they come up with and say. And yeah, it's such a great experience, but it's absolutely informed how I handle all of my relationships in a professional space. And some of it is I'm likely a little bit more off the cuff than I was when I was pre-parent. I'm likely more honest than it was pre-parent, because I think I'm looking at a lot of the interactions and going, if this is not your jam, that's totally fine. I'm here. We can talk about this again in the future. But if this isn't the time, that's also okay. But time is valuable. Nonprofit time, you know, I have 90% of the nonprofits I support, I'm always looking at it and going, how are you accomplishing everything you're doing, right? How is this even possible? So I do think having conversations about data, what you want to collect, can really save you time. And that's something that is a bit of a misconception, because there obviously is some front loading of work that's required, unless they get someone incredible like yourself in to handle some of these things. But it is, you know, gathering together the data afterwards. Now, what does this mean? What decisions are we going to make based on it? It is a piece of work for sure.
Like kids, data are labors of love.
Labors of love. Can you have that? Like, that should be your like LinkedIn byline, right? Like, that's the sales pitch right there, right? Labors of love. Data is a labor of love.
Right.
But I do think if you do it right and you take the time and care and energy in the same way that sometimes we're exhausted by parenting and you just want to throw on the TV and have it all like buzz noise out at the end of the day, the times when we've put the extra effort in for a games night and things like that always end up yielding great results, even if I have to convince myself that I have the energy for that, right? And maybe they're beating me more often at games because of it. So it's probably the right move. If I was at the top of my game, I'd crush them probably at Wingspan for the fifth time.
I love it. Well, thank you so much for an amazing conversation. I know that we could talk for hours and hours. So I very much appreciate your time today. And I look forward to many conversations like this in the future.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's super fun. And I enjoy your expertise on the subject of data, because it's something I'm constantly, you know, dipping my toes into, but your expertise on it is awesome. I'm glad there's someone out there for the nonprofit space doing this kind of work.
Well, thank you so much.
Okay, cheers.
That was Tasha Van Vlack, and I hope that you enjoyed our conversation as much as I did. There are so many lessons that we have learned from being parents, and even if you listening aren't a parent, there are so many lessons from your personal life, from the things that you have done, the challenges you have overcome, that make you as good as you are at what you do. And I hope that today's episode is an invite to embrace those challenges, to embrace those personal lessons you've learned in how they help you be better at what you do professionally. I would love to hear more from you, as would Tasha. So feel free to continue these conversations about the personal lessons you've learned that have helped you professionally with us on LinkedIn. You can find me, Alexandra Mannerines, on LinkedIn, and you can find Tasha Van Vlack, which is TashaVanVlack on LinkedIn. And we'll include links to our profiles, as well as the great people that Tasha was mentioning, on our show notes. You can find those in the notes if you're listening in a podcast player, or you can go to heartsouldata.com/EP-57. So again, this is episode 57. You can find those show notes at heartsouldata.com. Thank you so much for listening. I am grateful to you for the incredible work you do, and I hope you can find something that you're grateful for today too. You have been listening to Heart, Soul, and Data. This podcast is brought to you by Miraconous, an analytics education, consulting, and data services company devoted to helping nonprofits and social enterprises amplify their impacts and thrive through data. You can learn more at miraconos.com, M-E-R-A-K-I-N-O-S.com.